You're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. Good morning. You're listening to KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio. You're also listening to Praxis. Praxis receives support from Puffin Glass Studios, a purveyor of functional glass art and smoking accessories, 8 locations in the state of Washington. Information available at 509-328-0661 and online at puffinglassstudios.com. As I said, you're listening to Praxis. See, if you're just joining for the first time, this is a local, state, national, international, metaphysical, whatever I feel like talking about that day, talk program based in Spokane here. My name's Taylor. I'm your host. Today's show is going to be kind of random, but hopefully has some threads to tie it together. I know it has some threads to tie it together. I hope that you see them and find them interesting like I did. It's been a really busy week, and I feel like I harvested a lot of information from out in the world. And you're going to be hearing some live processing of that information. So that's kind of what it's all about. That's what I hope to do with this show. Hope to, you know, stimulate and open up room for in the broader community, just for people to ask questions. You know, I don't purport to be an expert on many of these topics. They're things that I find interesting. Ask the questions and start finding some of the answers, but usually just finding more questions. That's kind of what it's all about. So if that's what you're interested in, thanks for tuning in. So I thought when I first started this show a couple years ago, I forgot to celebrate my 2-year anniversary at the beginning of this month, but I'm glad that I've been here that long and that I'm still doing it, still doing the podcast and all of that. I thought it would be a lot newsier than it's become. And I think part of it is that I don't have a lot of patience for news in the traditional sense. It's interesting to follow things that are happening in the world, but just the world of news is frustrating for me. And this first story is going to be a reflection of that. This is probably a newsier show than I've had in a while, but I saw this popping up on various social media and just through friends, and I thought it was hilarious. I thought it was... It almost seems like it's from The Onion or satire because of how obvious the headline might seem to some of us who care about and follow these issues. U.S. is an oligarchy, not a democracy, says scientific study. And I just thought that was great. A study that's going to appear, who did the study? In the fall 2014 issue of the academic journal Perspectives on Politics, finds that the U.S. is no democracy, but instead an oligarchy, meaning profoundly corrupt, so that the answer to the study's opening question, who governs, who really rules, in the country is, quote, despite the seemingly strong empirical support in previous studies for theories of majoritarian democracy, our analyses suggest that majorities of the American public actually have little influence over the policies our government adopts. Americans do enjoy many features central to democratic governance, such as regular elections, freedom of speech and association, and a widespread, if still contested, franchise. But, and then they go on to say, it's not true, and that, quote, America's claims to being a democratic society are seriously threatened by the findings in this, the first ever comprehensive scientific study of the subject, which shows that there is instead, quote, the nearly total failure of median voter and other majoritarian electoral democracy theories of America. When the preferences of economic elites and the stands of organized interest groups are controlled for, the preferences of the average American appear to have only a minuscule, near zero, statistically non-significant impact upon public policy. To put it short, the United States is no democracy, but actually an oligarchy. It's, I suppose I have mixed feelings about this. I should also let you know I'm reading an article from commondreams.org by Eric Zeus, who this is his condensed, his summary of this study that the abstract's been released. And the authors of the study, there they are Martin Gillins and Benjamin I. Page. The article's titled Testing Theories of American Politics. The authors clarify, this is great too, that the data available are probably underrepresenting the actual extent of control of the U.S. by the super rich. They say, economic elite domination theories do rather well in our analysis, even though our findings probably understate the political influence of elites. Our measure of the preferences of wealthy or elite Americans, though useful and the best we could generate for a large set of policy cases, is probably less consistent with the relevant preferences than are our measures of the views of ordinary citizens or the alignments of engaged interest groups. Yet we found substantial estimated effects even when using this imperfect measure. The real-world impact of elites upon public policy may be still greater. So I think it's partially, I think it's great that people are actually quantifying this thing, that people who I think have even dipped a toe outside the box of our dominant culture and the dominant narrative, the official story, if you will, that folks know, especially folks who are not the elite, I think generally when they have attempted to engage in the political process by the traditional means and been disappointed, I think people understand this. It might be people who have not engaged in the process and have watched it as a sort of sporting event on cable news, you know, for whom this might be more of a surprise. But I think it's sort of ridiculous that we feel the need to do a study to show what seems fairly obvious. But it's also just more, you know, there's some people who want this type of hard evidence outside of the evidence of our political and economic and social reality. I think it's everywhere. If you look around, it's pretty clear that the average people haven't really been dictating what happens in this country and therefore around the world based on the, you know, the military empire and the economic empire that is largely based in this country that's foisted upon much of the rest of the world. So pretty interesting. I thought it was great to see that pop up on my feed. Like I said, originally thinking it was maybe from The Onion because it seems so obvious, but then I remember that it isn't necessarily obvious. I'm trying to keep that in mind, that there are at least two and probably many more than that realities going on for folks. And that's part of what I want to explore on the show today. What is real? What are we encouraged to believe is real? What is really real? And how can we find that out? I'll get there eventually, I hope. There's a lot of other things I want to cover before then. But so the U.S. is an oligarchy, not a democracy. Scientifically proven. It's not just wingnuts like myself and others making it up and saying it. And here, I'll finish this article on Common Dreams. Nonetheless, this is the first ever scientific study of the question of whether the U.S. is a democracy. Until recently, it has not been possible to test these contrasting theoretical predictions that U.S. policymaking operates as a democracy versus as an oligarchy versus as some mixture of the two against each other within a single statistical model. This paper reports on an effort to do so using a unique data set that includes measures of the key variables for 1,779 policy issues. That's an enormous number of policy issues studied. What the authors are able to find, despite the deficiencies of the data, is important. The first ever scientific analysis of whether the U.S. is a democracy or is instead an oligarchy or some combination of the two. The clear finding is that the U.S. is an oligarchy, no democratic country at all. American democracy is a sham, no matter how much it's pumped by the oligarchs who run the country and who control the nation's news media. The U.S., in other words, is basically similar to Russia or most other dubious electoral democratic countries. We weren't formerly, but we clearly are now. Today, after this exhaustive analysis of the data, the preferences of the average American appear to have only a minuscule, near zero, statistically non-significant impact upon public policy. That's it in a nutshell. So, that seems, if you're looking at it through a certain lens, that seems fairly disheartening. But it also I think there's a lot of good news in that, personally, and that's part of what we'll explore a little more through the hour. I don't know. I tend to be a person who thinks that the total failure of the systems that we have in this country, I guess, because that's my experience, obviously, will leave a good, when they eventually fail, which they're too dumb to survive. You know, I mean, things so poorly designed simply don't survive in nature. And I'd like to believe that that's going to follow through, here. In this case, there'll be a great vacuum in which all the creative, talented people who are not given voice in the current system can build the new in the shell of the old. I don't remember who said that, but I'm really fond of it. And maybe I'll try to find it while I play this video. So the reason the show's kind of freeform today is because my plan was to head to Olympia this last weekend, where the Rachel Corrie Foundation had their annual Peaceworks conference, during which they brought both Dr. Angela Davis and Noura Erekat, who was one of the two guides of the trip I took to Palestine in 2013. They're both amazing women, talking about, their keynote was called, Once Again as Captives, talking about mass incarceration, both of, people of color in the U.S. and, Noura was talking about, Palestinian mass incarceration, by Israel, State of Israel. And really sad to miss it. I couldn't wrangle my transportation properly to go. I was hoping to talk about that and hopefully interview one or both of them. Didn't happen. That's okay. There are more chances. And thankfully there are a lot of resources available for us online to peruse and share. And that is where I'm going to share this speech that Angela Davis gave. I was looking through different material of hers. There's a lot of really powerful speeches that she gave, you know, in the late 60s, the early 70s, during her time involved with the Black Panther Party and those movements, her time in jail and out of jail. And those are all really good. But I think, and I might share one from 1972 later, but I'm going to share this one because it fits in with that topic I just touched on, the U.S. oligarchy being scientifically proven. Before it was scientifically proven, you know, you may remember 3 years ago that people understood it in mass and went out to do a vague something. Some people had a more specific something in mind, but obviously talking about Occupy Wall Street, people turning out in the millions across the country to simply try to figure out to do actual democracy, the project of actual democracy, which is messy and complicated and involves a lot of sitting in circles and talking, and that's a lot of what was happening. Our news media, as you will also remember, there's no room for that kind of discussion in the corporate media that we have, so it had to make a mockery of this instead, you know, find the most ridiculous spectacle aspects. This speech was not broadcast on any corporate media, I'm sure. You know, Amy Goodman at Democracy Now!, there were other small news outlets. It was a really good time for the alternative media to turn out and amplify some of these voices. But even so, you know, it's hard to, this video that I'm going to share only has like 250 views online. So I hope that other people are accessing this information. We have these great tools to use. We'll talk more about those tools and some of the flaws in a while too. But anyway, to the point, this is Angela Davis talking October 30th, 2011 in Zuccotti Park. This is just after, at this time, where was I? I was coming back from California. I had decided to take that month of October and check out all the different Occupy encampments and actions on the West Coast that I could. And I had just been in San Francisco, which was amazing. I just wanted to stay at the camp in San Francisco forever, but obviously I had to come back. I didn't have to come back, but I chose to come back. And it was an intense time. It was when the police had violently attacked the protesters in Oakland. And she talks about this a little bit. The sound may be crazy at first because she's using the people's mic. Everyone will be repeating what she says back, which I think is really powerful. That was something else the news media went after, that it was this creepy, that it was this sound, people sounding like automatons. And that's not how I interpreted the use of that tool at all. It was more about patience, about having a conversation. You're really forced to listen to what someone is saying if you have to repeat it back in your own voice. And yeah, I think it's just awesome. So I'm going to play this as a way to, I don't know, apologize, make up for not being at that event in Olympia this weekend, and to just share with you the things that Angela Davis had to say in Zuccotti Park. And we can talk about why that's certainly not over 3 years later. Here's a group of people who understood that oligarchy was alive and well in the U.S. 3 years ago, before the study ever came out.
No to the devastation of the environment.
We say no.
We say no.
We stand united.
November 2nd.
November 2nd.
check!
Mic check!
Mic check!
I share with you.
I share with you.
I share with you.
The language of.
The language of.
The language of.
The poster.
The poster.
So that was the Angela Davis speech I wanted to share with you, I guess amplified by the folks at Zuccotti Park, and then apparently as a crowd gathers, amplified twice, and then once again here this morning. So that's part of what I want to talk about today. If you're just joining me, you're listening to Praxis, and that idea of, I mentioned before I started the speech, the idea of the people's mic, the mic check use that was made of people's voices during Occupy, that some people, a lot of people I knew were criticizing it and said it was, you know, creeping them out. But I think it was just wonderful, especially at the end there, just hearing like knowing that there were, you know, 10,000 people in that location all, you know, repeating back to have a general strike. Obviously, the participation wasn't wide enough for that kind of tactic to take hold then. Obviously the corporate, the everything industrial complex did its job in dismantling or changing that movement pretty widely. I think my own observation is that unfortunately a lot of people who were really energized and kind of activated by Occupy got diverted into the same old types of, you know, attempting to affect public policy, which we've just heard is scientifically not a sound strategy. If you're not part of the corporate elite, if you're not part of the, you know, what Occupy would call the 1%, if you're not part of that that oligarchic structure, then you know, don't bother, because the public policy effect that average people have is statistically insignificant, according to that study. And so, you know, I think getting back to some of these ideas that Occupy was putting forward that were successfully slandered, the slander was successful. The message isn't necessarily accurate, as impractical and crazy. Actually, you know, if folks just stop, like that's the whole concept of a general strike, is just withholding your personal support, and using it to build vibrant communities, as Dr. Angela Davis said in that speech. People have skills that they aren't allowed to express and use within the confines of what we have of global capitalism, which she named in the speech, which people were naming during that time. And it got parsed out and chopped into tiny pieces. So it was about, you know, it became about one, like, let's pass one bill. It became about the same old stuff. I have to remain calm so I can stay radio safe here. The same old stuff that people have been spinning their wheels on for years, with the exception of certain, you know, more radical movements looking at what can I bring? How can I contribute to a different kind of world? And how can we start? So, yeah, that's a big part of what I want to talk about. And there's this interesting article. It's really long, and I'm only going to share part of it and certain aspects of it that a listener sent to me. And it's from before this speech you just heard. So we're going back another almost year, to the end of 2010. And that's when a lot of the conversation that preceded Occupy was bubbling up, a lot of folks were getting kind of activated by that. The first WikiLeaks had kind of blown up and emerged. Julian Assange was starting to release some of these documents. All of this is starting in 2010. And so let's see. I'm looking for where to start in this article. It's by Laura Knight Jadzik, who I can't find very much on, but this listener sent me some information. And yeah, while I don't agree with everything she says, I think there's some interesting analysis that we can talk about, and then it'll lead us into talking about propaganda. Obviously, a lot of the time, this show is propagandizing in the traditional sense. The word really just means to communicate information meant to persuade. Even if I'm just trying to persuade you to, you know, ask questions and question the structures we have, that's still propagandizing. So I will admit now to being a propagandist, but we'll look at how the more broad, sweeping propaganda works, what you can do to resist it. And actually, this is going to be more relevant when we get there. So I'm going to leave it for now. So thinking about all of this, thinking about, you know, what happened to a lot of these folks who were participating in Occupy. Part of it I didn't mention. Obviously, there was the fear campaign, the othering. We'll look at some of the specific propaganda techniques that happened to convince average people who may have really identified with this idea of, you know, the 99% and of questioning corporate dominance, to keep them away and say, actually, no, these people are freaks. You're not like them. You're normal. You're going to be able to climb the ladder, and someday you too will be, you know, rich and famous and all the things that is part of this American mythology that we have. I think Ernest Hemingway, who was it? No. Shoot. Somebody said, and I'll find out who it was. I'll find it out right now. Said that Americans are just temporarily embarrassed millionaires. John Steinbeck, there we go. Socialism never took root in America because the poor see themselves not as an exploited proletariat, but as temporarily embarrassed millionaires. That was a big part. I think that was a huge part of the narrative of defaming Occupy and killing it in the media was about, you don't want to be like those hippie freaks. Look, they are dirty and they're just playing bongos, and what do they think this is, the 60s? And, you know, you don't want to be a dirty hippie. You're going to be a millionaire someday. Stick with us. So that, I think that was effective in some ways. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. But I was also thinking about surveillance, because that infiltration of those movements, it's been documented that, as usual, the FBI and other acronyms that are funded by you and I, and by other budgets that we can't see because they're black budgets. That's always fun to research. Had a part in destabilizing some of these groups, some of this organizing that was happening, sending people in just to sow chaos and then claim that, you know, chaos is bound to happen when you have voluntary participation in direct democracy, trying to build consensus, trying to build community like Occupy was. It really feeds this narrative that, you know, oh, humans are doomed to, anarchy means chaos, basically feeding that myth by ensuring that there will be chaos by creating it. And then the surveillance aspect is also huge. People who I think may otherwise be interested in participating in some kind of alternative to the current capitalist corporate dominated system that we have may be scared about the potential, the state power that exists in this country. The surveillance, the NSA revelations that we've had over the last couple years now, there's just more and more every day, which we'll talk about in a little more detail. It's insane. So basically, part of the reason I was thinking of all of this has to do with Get Lit. The Get Lit Festival just drew to a close, and it was great. I really always like, as a book nerd, that's my real background, is just someone who likes to read and tries occasionally to write because of that, wanting to make something that someone else would like to read someday. I attended one of the main events was Anthony Doerr and William T. Volman, talking about new books they each have and their work in general. And you may have read about William T. Volman coming in advance. And he wrote a great article about surveillance and about discovering his FBI file, which was something like 700 pages long. Because of his work, it had themes that were anti-growth and anti-progress. And therefore, because of that, because of some of his writing, which is highly not complimentary to the state as a structure, has a lot of ideas around that, which last time I checked, it's not illegal to have ideas like that. He was suspected of being the Unabomber. That's part of the reason his file's so large. And he used that story as a way to introduce himself. But I really liked, I managed to score the copy of his speech afterwards because I told him I wanted to write down this quote and I couldn't write fast enough. He said, the operatives, he's referring to normal people working within the NSA. I think that's something important to remember. These are just people whose job they are going to, in which they spy on people. He was talking about the NSA, TSA, FBI, etc. He says, the operatives, paid for out of our tax dollars, who spy on our telephone calls and open our mail, may not be the most intelligent readers and listeners that we've ever had, but at least some of them may be sincere. In case they ever wonder why we write, I now go on record. I like to create beautiful sentences. When the weak defy the strong who oppress them, when we who live, knowing that we die, live on, fighting the beautiful doomed battles of love and experience, when a maimed man strives to compete with a whole one as his equal, when a fantasist declines to be bound by what others call reality, when a saint or a revolutionary sacrifices himself for an idea, or a pathological liar persuades us of golden things, we defy reality. A pretty sentence is as brave and hopeless as any of the other examples in this list. I wish that I could help others in a more significant way than I have. My nonfiction has greater aspirations than my fiction toward being useful. Perhaps that is why it is so plain. My own novels are rarely jolly, and yet there can be beauty in the grimmest imaginings. How can this be? Don't ask me. Ask the most astute readers of all time, the FBI. So I just appreciated that sentiment of his. And it leads into, so I got one of his books, which as I read it, I'll share information from it. He did a comprehensive 7-volume, like over 3,000 page study on violence, what it is, all the types, exploring like a moral calculus, he says, for violence and its justifications and uses, which is a very ambitious project. I got the abridged version, which is not thousands of pages long, but only about 700. So he spoke, and then Anthony Doerr also spoke. Both of them tend to have work that's, well, their latest work, at least that they read from, is about war and about normal people caught up in crazy systems. And I got Anthony Doerr's book. I'm currently reading it. All the Light We Cannot See. And it's one of the best works I've read about World War II. It's a period of time I think we're culturally fascinated with. It's epic, to be sure, for better or worse. It was a very epic time in history. A lot of things that hadn't been seen before. There was a lot of technology being used that had never been applied to war before. And I think that's what made it unique. That's what made it so extreme. Made the violence so extreme. And I think there's a lot we can learn from that time in history. I think there's a lot of misguided reference to World War II, but there's also a lot we can learn. Some of my favorite fiction and nonfiction takes place then. And before I get into that too much, I'll let you know where you are. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Praxis on KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio. I'm your host, Taylor. We're talking about all kinds of stuff. We're talking about resistance, surveillance, mass movements, propaganda, why people do or don't, you know, rise up. What are ways to do that that work? What are ways that don't work? We're going to not solve all of it this hour, but the questions are what's important. Yeah, that's what's important. So anyway, something I was really struck by in my two favorite books, because I'm not finished with Dorr's book, but it's quickly becoming one of my favorite fictions, at least about World War II. And my other, which is Every Man Dies Alone by Hans Falada. He wrote it in like a quick burst while he was in and out of prison just before he died. It's based on a true story, and it follows two German citizens who slowly become disenchanted with Nazism, basically, with the Reich, and they decide to mount what resistance they can, and it comes in the form of dropping these small postcards. They propagandize. They write postcards with, messages against the state, with questions, and they write one a week and drop it somewhere in a public location, and it follows their expectation of what's happening. They imagine all these people everywhere picking them up and, you know, joining the resistance even in their mind. And it tracks what actually happens to them. It's a downer of a book, but it's really, really great nonetheless. And in a similar fashion, Dorr's book follows, without giving away too much, particularly because it's not out yet, it follows a story of also of resistance and of the use of technology. It follows both a German soldier who is a really talented engineer. He's a young guy. They cheat so he can get in earlier. And he works with radio. So obviously I have a soft spot for this book because it's about radio. And it also follows a group of French folk who are being occupied by the German army, resisting in what ways they can. They're trying to get out messages, and one of the ways is by broadcasting these illegal radio broadcasts. Some of them are in code. Some are messages that people smuggle to them. They want their families to know where they are, things like that. And they'll also just play music. They'll play the music that's, you know, forbidden because it's not German. So I have obviously a soft spot for this book because it's about radio. But it also brought to mind what was different about World War II, why people are so fascinated with it, and what we might be able to learn now when we also have, once again, you know, it's not radio this time, but we have the internet, we have social media, we're building maps of our connections with other people, we're putting out declarations of who we are and what we believe and what we care about into a net. It's called the net, that maps us all together in really beautiful ways, but also in ways that have implications politically and in terms of surveillance, which we're just now starting to understand and explore a little bit out in our conversation. And what's concerning about that, I will share with you. The thing that I think is disturbing, that's captivated people, that's been kind of uniquely... It was unique at the time, disturbing about World War II, specifically about the Nazi regime's tactics, were it was really one of the first times that division of labor, these industrial ideas, were put into war, so that someone could be participating in something like the Holocaust, something like, you know, death camps and work camps. While, you know, they're just going to work and they're just pushing a button over and over again all day, just like they were in the factory, only now it's a much different type of factory and a much more horrific one. And the book sort of talks about that. This young man is just fascinated by math, by radios, and he uses trigonometry to build a series of receivers that can pinpoint the location of a broadcast as it's coming out. And obviously this has military applications that he's not really interested in. He doesn't really want to go kill people who are illegally broadcasting radio, but he's built it all with the math. You know, his fascination's been taken advantage of, and obviously it's still up to him. That's the point of the book I'm not to yet. It's still up to him to go along with it or not. And that's the part that I think people leave out. People have a choice all along. It's a really difficult choice to make, but so the mathness of that conflict was pretty fascinating, the way it was all chopped into pieces and separated like that. And now we have a very similar type of tool. And so this is from The Intercept, the finally, you know, manifested journalistic project with Laura Poitras, Jeremy Scahill, Glenn Greenwald. And this is an article that Jeremy Scahill and Glenn Greenwald wrote together in February of this year. So it's pretty recent. And it talks about the NSA's secret role in the U.S. assassination program. And when I read this, it was perfect timing reading it alongside this book, you know, about this boy using radio to locate people. Now we have even way more advanced tools. We can use metadata to track who's talking about what topics where, you know, where a concentration of resistance or, you know, unfavorable opinion lies. And then we have these drones also. I mean, the ultimate abstraction, maybe not ultimate, but so far abstraction of our use of violence. Someone can be sitting in a room in California, you know, gunning people down in Pakistan or Yemen or Afghanistan or anywhere. And that has repercussions that should be more obvious than they apparently are, since so many people still support using this technology. So here's what they say. This is, again, Jeremy Scahill and Glenn Greenwald. They say, the National Security Agency is using complex analysis of electronic surveillance rather than human intelligence as the primary method to locate targets for lethal drone strikes, an unreliable tactic that results in the deaths of innocent or unidentified people. According to a former drone operator for the military's Joint Special Operations Command, JSOC, who also worked with the NSA, the agency often identifies targets based on a controversial metadata analysis and cell phone tracking technologies. Rather than confirming a target's identity with operatives or informants on the ground, the CIA or the U.S. military then orders a strike based on the activity and location of the mobile phone a person is believed to be using. The drone operator, who agreed to discuss the top secret programs on the condition of anonymity, was a member of JSOC's high-value targeting task force, which is charged with identifying, capturing, or killing terrorist suspects in Yemen, Somalia, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. His account is bolstered by top-secret NSA documents previously provided by whistleblower Edward Snowden. It's also supported by a former drone sensor operator within the U.S. Air Force, Brandon Bryant, who has become an outspoken critic of the lethal operations in which he was directly involved in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Yemen. In one tactic, the NSA geolocates the SIM card or handset of a suspected terrorist's mobile phone, enabling the CIA and U.S. military to conduct night raids and drone strikes to kill or capture the individual in possession of the device. The former JSOC drone operator is adamant that the technology has been responsible for taking out terrorists and networks of people facilitating improvised explosive device attacks against U.S. forces in Afghanistan. But he also states that innocent people have absolutely been killed as a result of the NSA's increasing reliance on the surveillance tactic. One problem, he explains, is that targets are increasingly aware of the NSA's reliance on geolocating and have moved to thwart the tactic. Some have as many as 16 different SIM cards associated with their identity within the high-value target system. Others, unaware that their mobile phone is being targeted, lend their phone with the SIM card in it to friends, children, spouses, and family members. So this, and it goes on, I'll share this full article. It's very long, and I'm, as usual, being a little too wordy and looking like I'll be running out of time before I get to everything I want to get to. But I was just so struck by the similarity there, the problems when you rely on, you know, what sounds great, to some, it sounds exact when you say you're going to use pure logic or you're going to be mathematical in your approach. But that discounts humanness. Humans are not always logical. They're not as predictable as numbers. And using that as the strategy, particularly when it also makes the humans involved abstract. You'll notice even in the article, the language that they use talking about this former JSOC drone operator, the targets, using this kind of language to identify people is all part of what leads to, such horrifying things. It's dehumanizing to people. It's it reduces people to blips on a spreadsheet, and coupled with the intense propaganda that we have coming from the state in the U.S., from the military-industrial complex, the fear that's struck in people by that, the sophisticated way that the corporate media's been able to propel those messages forward for years and years, is what makes all of this possible. It's what keeps people participating, whether, as we talked about last week on the show with Char Lichty and Bobby Curl, whether it's through regular taxpayers supporting with their money these, the military in huge disproportion to the rest of the federal budget, whether it's people, who join the military out of desperation, going along with these missions that they're placed on, that are, if you look at it from an evidence perspective, are ineffective, are actually making the world more dangerous, are not serving anyone other than the corporations who wish to protect their assets in those places. And then, down to everyday people who work for these big banks, who do the legwork every day. That's why I think at the beginning of this hour, when I played that that speech Angela Davis gave at Zuccotti Park in 2011, that call for general strike was so powerful. But it's also something that I think the average American does not have the political sophistication, nor, more importantly, the personal confidence to participate in. And that's what we need to focus on, I think. I mean, having people have the self-respect to believe that they deserve better is a huge part of what needs to happen. And also just understanding what part they currently play. It's not as though, individual CEOs, this is something that my partner Chris has helped me see in a series of dramatic arguments that we've had over the years. But it's not CEOs or generals who are sowing all this chaos and tragedy and horror throughout the world and destroying the planet. It's millions of people who are following their orders. So, and that's kind of the core of it. So, but this mathization of war and of life is dangerous. And it also, when we understand the world so much through social media and have this lack of personal, really have a lack of understanding of ourselves, talked about this with different people. I'd like to explore it more when I have more than 6 minutes left. But when, we have this focus on image like never before in our culture, you have a Facebook, you put out exactly what you want to put out about yourself into the world. You're in control of it. You have full editorial control of who you are to your friends online, to your colleagues, whoever you wish to present yourself to the NSA primarily. You have control over that. But at the same time, because of the image focus, I think that people are focusing less on what they actually do, who they actually are, and what that actually means for them. And then we end up with folks who, deprived of critical thinking capacity based on the failure of our, or success of our education system, depending on how you look at it, with no real with no perceived, they perceive that they may be able to have an impact on politics. But as we saw at the beginning, with our oligarchy rather than democracy, that's an illusion. They have faith in an illusion and a lack of knowledge about where their real political power lies. That is where we get problems like, again, our friends at the NSA, being more sophisticated than average consumers are in regards to social media, the idea of things being viral. And I don't know if people were following the story at the beginning of this month about the Cuban Twitter scam. Again, this is Glenn Greenwald at firstlook.org, The Intercept. He says the Cuban Twitter scam is a drop in the internet propaganda bucket. This week, this is the first week of April, the Associated Press exposed a secret program run by the U.S. Agency for International Development to create a Twitter-like Cuban communications network run through secret shell companies in order to create the false appearance of being a privately owned operation. Unbeknownst to the service's Cuban users was the fact that American contractors were gathering their private data in the hope that it might be used for political purposes, specifically to manipulate those users in order to foment dissent in Cuba and subvert its government. According to top-secret documents published today by The Intercept, this sort of operation is frequently discussed at Western intelligence agencies, which have plotted ways to covertly use social media for propaganda, deception, mass messaging, and pushing stories. These ideas, discussions of how to exploit the internet, specifically social media, to surreptitiously disseminate viewpoints friendly to Western interests and spread false or damaging information about targets, appear repeatedly throughout the archive of materials provided by NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden. Documents prepared by the NSA and its British counterpart, GCHQ, and previously published by The Intercept as well as some by NBC News, detailed several of those programs, including a unit devoted in part to discrediting the agency's enemies with false information spread online. The documents in the archive show that the British are particularly aggressive and eager in this regard, and formally shared their methods with the U.S. counterparts. One previously undisclosed top-secret document prepared by GCHQ for the 2010 annual SIGDEV gathering of the Five Eyes Surveillance Alliance comprising the UK, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and the US explicitly discusses ways to exploit Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, and other social media as secret platforms for propaganda. And this is a slide from that slideshow that they shared there. And it says the bullet points along the side say propaganda, deception, mass messaging, pushing stories, alias development, and psychology. So this is too long for me to share the rest of, but I think this is a conversation I want to continue next week. And basically the point I want to make is that it's more important than ever to be literate, not just able to read critically, able to understand images. We're such an image-based society that being able to dissect, look at images, think, who is creating this image? Who is in it? What's it trying to say about me in relation to it? Why would someone want to show it to me? Asking these basic questions is more important than ever, because propaganda is more sophisticated than posters, than pamphlets being spread throughout cities, like they were, you know. When we think of propaganda, I think that people in the U.S. most fiercely think about Nazi propaganda, Soviet propaganda during the Cold War, and our own, you know, buy war bonds. You see the pretty girl buying war bonds. You see Rosie the Riveter, you know, we can do it. Like, that's all propaganda. But today, you know, we have these sophisticated tools that we need to make sure we stay at least as sophisticated as our tools that we're using, that we think about who's behind the screen in all those different senses. And yeah, that's a big part of it. So the original article I wanted to share talked about that. This is what a listener sent to me. And where is the part? It talks about deconditioning, and that's a topic that I'll come back to. People to say that people in America are not deeply socially conditioned and culturally conditioned to support the corporate oligarchy that we've now scientifically proven that we have would be a mistake. And it's up to people to help decondition themselves and each other. You know, just watch yourself, watch other people, and have the conversation about how to make it right and how to figure out practical ways of fixing, you know, the mess we're in. And the comfort now is that science has told us that don't bother with the traditional methods, and just, you know, make yourself less malleable to other people's ideas, including mine. Please go and just think and read and ask the questions, because that's what's important. And yeah, I'll be back next week. Sorry that I didn't really get to my full point there until the end, but the hour always flies by. Thanks so much for listening. If you just caught the end and you want to hear the beginning of the show, if you're curious about who this crazy person is and what they talk about the rest of the time, I have great guests. Like to have guests in the studio so it's not me rambling every week. You can check out the podcast. The full archive is at praxisradio509.podomatic.com. You can also follow it on kyrs.org under programs, podcasts, Praxis. You can subscribe there or on Podomatic. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll be back next week. You're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM.